the background.
Blog Talk Radio.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. This is your host, Dan Zupansky, for the program True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. When the infamous gangster Whitey Bulger went on the lam in 1995, the streets of Boston became a war zone between the Mafia and the Renegades, with the Winter Hill Gang looking on. Rogue Mobster, the untold story of Mark Silverman and the New England Mafia, chronicles the inside story of the Boston mob wars of the 1990s, when over two dozen gangsters were killed in a vicious war for control of the Boston underworld. Rogue Mobster is told in the words of Mark Silverman, an outsider from Medford who got inside the mob and became an integral part of the ensuing war. His account is the first ever inside glimpse into what went on at the street level, why people were killed, and what the stakes really were. Silverman grew up in the shadow of Whitey Bulger, Howie Winter, Raymond Patriarca, and Jerry Angelo, bosses of Boston's most infamous crime families. With a Jewish last name, his opportunity should have been limited in Boston's Irish-Italian underworld, but he moved up quickly, gaining acceptance across the board. Silverman was made in the Patriarca family as a reward for infiltrating a renegade mob faction backed by a New York family. The book begins with a unique history of the Boston gangland scene and takes the reader right up to the late 1980s. Silverman recounts the shifting alliances and friendships that were torn apart as the various mob factions battled for control of the Boston underworld through the early 2000s. Rogue Mobster is a first-hand account of the violent mob wars of the 1990s when bodies were piling up across New England and Mark Silverman was walking a tightrope between Winter Hill and the Mafia. The book this evening that we're featuring is Rogue Mobster with my special guests Mark Silverman and Scott Deechy. Welcome to the program, gentlemen, and thank you to agreeing to this interview, Mark Silverman and Scott Deechy.
Well, thanks for having us on.
No, appreciate it.
Thank you very much. You're welcome. I'm pretty excited for our audience to hear another. We normally don't do too many stories, mob stories, but this is a very exciting one. And with this inside access that we have here, this is kind of unique, even in this sort of genre. So let's get right to it. Please, whoever wants to go first here, maybe Mark, I would think. Maybe you can tell us, set the setting for our audience, where exactly this is in Boston, what kind of neighborhood this is, what's the makeup of the neighborhood. Let's maybe even set the year, what year this story begins, basically, and what was the mood there at that time. Take us back to the area in Boston where this story is set, and take us back, please.
Well, there's a couple of neighborhoods that are involved mostly in this story, and one of them is called Winter Hill, and that's in Somerville, Massachusetts. And that's a predominantly Irish neighborhood, and it's notorious for the strength of its organized crime. But there's also the north end of Boston, which is mostly Italian, and those two groups are integral to the story. And that's kind of where it began. It began right around 1989, around that time, when the Patriarca crime family actually had an internal war, because the family split into two factions, and one of the factions was a renegade faction from within the family. In other words, these guys got together and they wanted to make a play for power. They wanted to take down the existing hierarchy of the Patriarca family, which I term Cosa Nostra. And that lasted for about 5 years, up until about maybe 94, 95. And that's when the federal government came in and they took down most of the renegade faction. But in the mafia, it multiplies. So when those guys went to jail, another faction that represented them came up. And in 95, when all this stuff was clearing, as they were clearing out the remnants of that original renegade faction, Whitey Bulger and Frank Cadillac Salemi, they were the two leaders. Whitey Bulger, of course, being the leader of the Irish mob, and Frank Cadillac Salemi being the leader of Cosa Nostra. When the indictments came down for those guys in 95, they both decided to go on the lam. And Frank Salemi lasted about 7 months on the lam, and Whitey Bulger, as I'm sure maybe your audience knows, and maybe you know, he lasted almost 17 years on the lam. So my point being is that during that time when the two main leaders were on the lam and unaccounted for, it just began an all-out fight for power. People tried to fill the void, and that's pretty much where I came into the scene.
Okay, we're gonna go switch to Scott Deechee and ask him a question I'm really curious about, how you became involved with this project, Scott, and why it was of interest to you as a writer. And you can give us your background if you'd like. We'd like to hear that. And tell us why this story compelled you to write this book. And tell us when and where you made that decision and why. Tell us, please.
Yeah, absolutely. I started getting interested in organized crime and writing, started writing some articles online on the web back late 90s, early 2000s, and then wrote my first book, Cigar City Mafia, about the Tampa underworld. That came out in 2004. About a year after that, I got an email from Mark. You know, I'd been approached by a lot of people. I've written a few books since then on the mafia, and I get approached by people fairly regularly about writing stories and, you know, hey, I was involved in this, and this. When Mark contacted me, I thought he had a really interesting take on it. Number one, Mark's only a couple years older than me, so he's pretty young. So that was one thing, you know, here's someone I can relate to. This is not some guy in his 80s that's recalling stuff that happened way back when.
Yeah.
But, you know, for all the exciting stuff that had been going on in Boston, there really hadn't been a lot of the books dealing with Boston organized crime dealt with Whitey Bulger exclusively, and there was so much else going on that just wasn't told. And here's a guy who had a really good kind of, we were all outside looking in, but he was inside looking in, and he had a really good perspective on it. And it was just a really good story. And the one other thing I liked about it is Mark doesn't pull any punches in dealing with what he did. It's not like, woe is me, I was in this life. You know, he's pretty frank about his involvement and what he did. And, you know, that's kind of a refreshing change of pace from a lot of these mob tell-alls that you read.
Okay. Now, Mark, you kind of skipped ahead a little bit in the book for anybody sort of listening in our audience. So I'm going to just ask you to take us back to how the heck you became involved in organized crime, why organized crime seemed attractive to you. Obviously, most people in our audience are going to be saying, well, you know, how did you do this? How were you influenced to become a gangster? Why would you want to become a gangster? And, you know, what kind of environment did you grow up that this was an option for you? So tell us a little bit about that. Take us back.
Well, back in those days, you know, I was an impressionable kid. And I had grown up in the greater Boston area in Medford and Somerville. And even as a teenager, I had always seen these guys. And, I was no different than most kids. I mean, I was running around with the street toughs, and I was looking at these guys as maybe, guys who got respect, guys who got things done, guys that were somebodies in our neighborhood. And when I was in high school, I was pulling off some petty crimes, and I was making some decent money. And I went to college for a year after that, but I was living in the Winter Hill neighborhood of Massachusetts, and that's actually in Somerville, Massachusetts. And when I was living there, I began meeting some very, very high-ranking Winter Hill gangsters. And I actually began to get noticed by some of the senior members of the gang, some of the guys that have been around a long time, and some guys that I really looked up to. So I was kind of torn between, do I stay in school or do I make this transition into this life? Because at that age, you're not really thinking about your future. You're saying, wow, you know, this looks like it might be, you know, it's instantly gratifying, you know. At least that's how I thought. But I began as a driver for the guy that I'm speaking of, one of the old-time members of the gang. And he took me under his wing, and he just took a liking to me. And, excuse me, we had like a grandfather-grandson type of relationship. He just, a lot of these older guys, a lot of the guys that have been around a long time, what they like to do is they like to, they like to mentor the younger guys that they see. I mean, they're not going to pick just any random guy off the street, but they saw something in me that they thought maybe that they could groom, they could, like a piece of clay that they could mold. And I don't know if they manipulated me or I was a willing participant, but I eventually began driving and collecting some Shylock money from some of their operations. They started introducing me around town to some real heavy hitters, and I was a young kid, and I was awestruck. I was like, you know, this looks like it could be really something good. So at that point, there was no more going back to school. My school was going to be on the streets. And at that point, it started to grow. I mean, I became their protege. I became the guy that they began grooming, that they began relying on. I mean, I was 19, 20 years old, and I'm going out collecting envelopes for guys that are notorious in the Boston underworld. I mean, legends. And, you know, I played the game. I enjoyed it, and I began to grow.
Now, you're talking about, and you mentioned it prior, you know, predominantly in the book about the distinction between what went on here, the renegade faction you talked about and alluded to. We'll talk about that in a little bit. But this is La Cosa Nostra. These are Italians, and for anybody that doesn't know about this, it's at least legend has it anyway that the Italians want to pick Italians so that they can trace them all the way back to the old country to make sure that the guy's good. What was your family like? What was your parents and your family like that you were in this kind of neighborhood? And did that have any influence on you getting involved in organized crime, your family itself and your background, your environment that you grew up in?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I have a Jewish last name, but I'm actually half Sicilian. And that comes from my mother's side. And my mother's father, my grandfather, was actually an Italian gangster. But his brother, my uncle, was an Irish gangster. So it was kind of a mix. But on my father's side, it was Irish. So it was kind of like a smorgasbord of, you know, in my immediate family. I had all these ties to the organized crime, and it was kind of crazy. But, yeah, you're right about the Italian thing, absolutely. But in Boston, I don't know if you're your listeners are familiar with this, but in Boston, it was actually more like an Irish thing because of, you know, guys like Whitey Bulger and guys like Howie Winter and Joe McDonald and those guys. But, yeah, they were part of Cosa Nostra to a point, you know, but they held their own. And it's a very unique situation in the Boston area. So that's those are kind of like my family roots.
And you talked about Patriarca, too, being part of La Cosa Nostra. Well, let's fully explain that. He had enough respect that when he went to New York, he had some influence. He sat down with these people. So he sat down with the biggest mafia leaders in America or in the world.
Well, he actually, you know, there was a 60s Irish gang war that originally, this was way before my time, obviously, but Raymond Patriarca, to end that war, he threw his support behind the Irish Winter Hill Gang, and that was the beginning of a love-hate relationship between the Italians and the Irish. But it was because of Raymond Patriarca and the power that he wielded, as you said, as you alluded to, he held a seat on the National Commission. He was the CEO of the New England Mafia, and he was the leader of Cosa Nostra. But because he was backing up the Irish during their internal power struggle that they had in the 60s, they actually merged. And he took a real liking to these Irish guys. And you combine the two together, and you get a very strong army.
Now, Scott, what was the research that was entailed in writing this book? How did you go about getting this information from Mark? Mark, did he use a recorder? Did he write stuff down? You guys have conversations. You had said you'd already done a fair amount of research, so tell us exactly how this came about, this account.
Sure. it was a couple steps there. One of the things was that Mark had already written down a lot of just notes and ideas and memoirs, if you will, kind of unstructured, and he sent that to me, and I would help him formulate the story, getting his side of it. And then I'd go back and check it and, you know, fill in some gaps with the official record, if you will, law enforcement reports, congressional hearings, newspaper articles, magazine articles, talk to some people, mob historians and other authors and other sources. And then I'd actually gone up to Boston and visited with Mark, and he, you know, he drove me around some of the neighborhoods so I can get a feel for that area as well, and then recorded some conversations with him. And so it was kind of like a little mix and match of a few different styles. But Mark had a lot of really good stuff written down that he had produced over the years and keeping track of this great story, because it is a little complex. So, you know, what we want to do is really just make sure we got the narrative straight, but you don't want to fudge the facts. So just and I think it comes off the way we did it, really, in a chronological fashion, where you really get to see all the manipulations and the switching sides and all the craziness that was going on. And I, you know, Mark really did a good job, I should say, of relaying that.
Yeah, you know what I really think is really great too is that, you know, everybody that reads a mob book now, organized crime book, has been affected by Goodfellas and Sopranos and, of course, The Godfather, right? Everybody. I mean, there's just no one on earth that hasn't. So, you know, you get sort of those visuals because it's still otherworldly to most people. It really isn't normal or regular or even comprehensible, you know. So, but what's really interesting is that because Mark has this inside access, I've never read a book like this that has the intimate details, and we'll talk about that as well. Now, Mark, what's interesting in this book, I've heard, you know, you talk about, too, the betrayal, that there's no loyalty. The way these guys get to each other, bumping them off, is basically their best friend, you know, the guy that they can hang out with them. And you said, listen, you learned early on that just because a guy hangs out with you doesn't mean he's your friend. But what I was talking about to the audience was the intimate details of the betrayal in terms of relationships, and that's what runs a theme through this book as well, which just adds more humanity to this thing. Now, tell us just a little bit, and again, we might be jumping up a little bit, but tell us about, you know, this very, very important figure in your life, Maria, and tell us who Maria is, how you meet her, who she is. And just introduce who Maria is, please, and when and how you came about to meet her.
Well, one of the very first people that I started out with in my own crew was a guy named Bobby Rennell. And Bobby was a few years older than me. And he was, like I said, he was, you know, you made a point about friends in the mob. I mean, we palled around every day, and we were, considered best friends or whatever. But in the mob, you really have associates. But Maria was actually the on-again, off-again girlfriend of him. And when he went to prison, he went to prison when the war really kicked off. And I was kind of left on the street to fend for myself. And as he went away, Maria and I started to get into contact because I felt as though that maybe Bobby was trying to use her to see if I might make an advance on her, to see if because I thought that maybe she might be a spy for him. I thought that, you know, when you're in prison and, you know, your friend or your guy, the guy that you earn with, he's on the street, I mean, you're thinking all kinds of crazy things. I mean, you want to get as many people as close to him as you can. And I had the reputation for I don't know, sleeping around with some of the enemy wise guys' girlfriends. And the later it got into a sentence, he was serving a 5 to 7 year prison term. And he asked me, he said, of all the people to ask, he says, you know, can you keep an eye on Maria? And right there was a red flag, because I said, of all the people, you're going to ask me to keep an eye on your girlfriend? I mean, you know my reputation. So I kind of thought it was, he wanted to get her to see if I would betray him. Because in my mind, I felt as though he had already started to betray me. This is what you were speaking of, too, with the friendship, your best friends, and shifting alliances and all of that stuff, is that at that point in our relationship, when I met Maria, him and I, we just weren't trusting each other, because I felt as though he was on one side of the war and he felt as though maybe I was on the other. So he figured maybe with the girl he could find out exactly where I was. And that's how that became.
Now tell us a little bit about this. I mean, it might be typical to you, but tell us why there was this split in this family. Obviously people pick people to be in families, and they test out their alliances and their loyalties. So then what is the specific reason why this group had this renegade faction?
Well, that's kind of a complex question, but the short answer on that is the fact that when the top leaders go down via prison or the other way, other guys are trying to step up and take their positions. And that happens, you know, in the 80s, and it happened again in 95, as I've already alluded to. And what actually started it, though, was in New York, when John Gotti and Sammy Gravano, they made a power play in the Gambino family. They clipped Tommy Bilotti and Big Paul Castellano, and that was a very, very touchy situation, because that's the one thing you don't do is in the mafia and Cosa Nostra, even going back to Sicily especially, is that the boss is the boss is the boss. You know, whether you like him or you don't, it's not about liking him. It's you take orders from him, you accept the fact that he is your boss, and you honor him. And when they made that move, they had actually been recruiting people in the other five families to actually make the move with them. So when that happens, now you've got other families that are splitting into two, because, you know, Gotti and Gravano are basically saying that, you know, if you don't come with us, you'll be considered against us. And naturally,
right,
they'll try to take you out. So New England kind of followed suit, because New York kind of controls the New England Mafia to a point, too. And when people saw that Gotti and Gravano had done that the Gambinos had made that power play, they thought it was okay to follow suit, because they wanted to go with maybe that rogue faction of the Mafia that they were creating by taking out the underboss and the boss of the Gambino family. So that's
kind of how
it all started. And it took a long time to really pick up steam and to really make everything go.
Right. Now, you talk about indictments, the major indictments, so there's a few of them in this book that create, obviously, that sort of accelerates a lot of breakdowns of gangs and alliances and loyalties, doesn't it, when you get indictments. And like you said, Whitey Bulger and Fellini or Flemmy, they took off. So tell us more about the indictments. What exactly, like we just alluded to, that this is about drug dealing, but we're going to talk about other things that you were involved with as well. Tell us about what kind of crime these guys were indicted for, and what happened with the first major indictment, and in what year was those first major indictments, and what was the result of that?
Well, I'll take it into two stages. In 1984, Raymond Patriarca Sr. died. And in 1986, Jerry Angiulo and his brothers were indicted and sent off to prison. So in a matter of 2 years, you have a family that has been under absolute leadership, Raymond Patriarca being the boss of the family and Jerry Angiulo being the underboss. They are no longer in the equation. So this is around 86. So naturally, by this time, there's problems, because there's a power vacuum. As I was saying, you know, I don't want to jump up again, but by the time 1989 came about, the thing that really ignited the war within the family was a guy named Frank Cadillac Salemi was, he was sanctioned as the new boss around 1989, and they tried to kill him. He was shot. They lured him to a peace meeting. At least that's what he thought it was going to be, and they tried to take him out. Where simultaneously down in Rhode Island, it was the murder actually happened in Connecticut, but his underboss was clipped in the same month. So now, as those two guys tried to take over, the Renegades took him out. The only problem is Salemi lived. He took a couple of bullets, and naturally there's going to be, you know, fighting back. And that's when the family really, really divided. Is now, obviously, right. Salemi and his loyalists are very upset. You know, you just killed his underboss. You took a shot at him. You tried to convince him that it was a peace meeting. So that's what kicked off the first wave of it, as I was telling you. But if you turn up the clock to 95, you know, now you got Salemi and Bulger getting indicted along with other guys that are high-ranking figures. So it's almost like deja vu to a point, because now there's another leadership vacuum. You got Bulger and Salemi that are gone in 95. So, again, what happens? The other renegade faction from the Italian mafia, they try to fill the void. And that's where we're at.
Right. Now, Scott, with your research, obviously you didn't rely, again, you spoke about doing research side by side with the kind of information that Mark gave you that you might not have access to with, you know, official records. What about the New England mafia after writing this book? Was different than some of the other crime families that you've covered? Well, what was different about the New England family? What was that little bit of flavor that was a little bit different that was seemed to be interesting and part of this story? What was unique about the New England mafia?
A couple things. First of all, the ethnic makeup, as Mark said before, you had that real strong Irish presence, which in a lot of other cities had died out by the 1930s, but here it is in the 1980s, 90s, current in Boston, where that's still going on. And there's just something about the flavor, like when you go there and you read about these guys and you see it, it's kind of an intangible thing that you have this flavor about the New England mafia that's different than, say, New York. It's not quite as sophisticated. It's not quite as, you know, $2,000 suits and pinky rings. It's a little more blue collar. And
right.
In doing the research and talking to Mark, it's really very neighborhood based. It's really very street based, which is different than a lot of the other smaller families around the country. Everyone has their own little quirks and charms, but those are the real things that kind of set New England apart. And the last thing, too, is the way that it's spread out geographically. You have a couple centers of power that flip-flop back and forth, like Raymond Patriarca ran the family out of Rhode Island, but, you know, Salemi was based out of Boston. And then, you know, recent bosses have flip-flopped between the power being either in Providence or in Boston. So that's also kind of a unique situation that a lot of other families don't have.
Dan, if I could interrupt for 1 second, too. I'm just going to come right out and say this. You have to remember something, too. Whitey Bulger, in any other family, let's say New York, Chicago, even Florida, a guy that is an Irish mobster could never become the most powerful mob boss in any city. But in Boston, he had been working with the FBI since 1975. And in order to keep him safe, the FBI decided the best way to go about that was to make the Italians fight each other and whack each other out. And that's basically, they kind of started the war. I mean, I've made references to the street angle of what the war was about and how the factions split. But the FBI was creating this situation to keep Bulger insulated and in South Boston as an Irish leader. But the above all boss of all bosses was him, because they were protecting him. And as I said, he was insulated in South Boston. And to keep him safe, the major people around him got to go down, but especially the Italians. The Italians were just collateral damage to keep him safe. And it just caused so many problems. But that's basically what it is, and it's very sad. But that's what happened.
Well, you do say in your book, and I've never read this before, that basically the FBI were much because you read a lot about, you know, some of the missteps of mobsters, and some people will say, well, they weren't so smart. You know, John Gotti blabbing and lots of guys blabbing, and people would make light of that. But what I'm talking about is that these guys basically, like you say, insulated themselves, the FBI basically knew what was going on one step ahead of everyone. So they sort of knew the psychology of mobsters, and then played those egos and those paranoid kind of characters against each other. And like you say, when they can protect a mobster, let him succeed, and then arrest people around them, people start wondering who is working for who. And so you really do talk about how the FBI really played the mobsters one against each other.
Sure. And that's what has to happen, unfortunately, because, you know, if you're going to protect somebody, you got to clear the way. You know, I mean, you got to also create, you know, they got to keep making high profile arrests too. And, you know, the thing in New England, as we alluded to earlier, is the fact that the Irish were the smaller group. So the FBI targeted the Italian Cosa Nostra, and they figured the best way to infiltrate them, the best way to take them down, is to get a guy like Bulger, an Irishman, to give him information and help them destroy the larger group, which of course would go into New York and go into other ethnic areas. But that was their original plan. And they seemed to carry it out pretty well because, like I said, they were pretty much responsible indirectly, however you want to say it, however you want to paint it to anybody. But that's really what caused it.
Right. Now, tell us a little bit more about how you rose in this organized crime. I mean, obviously you weren't – well, not obviously, but you talk about – working with different crews and different gangs and different families, and then surviving this entire war. Take us further. Take our audience further into the story, where what you're doing, and specifically your drug dealing, you're doing other rackets. So tell us everything that you're involved with, who you're working with. Once some of these people are in this power vacuum. And just continue with the story of what you're doing and who you're working with and what you're achieving in terms of your rise in organized crime.
Well, like I was saying earlier, is when I was coming up in the underworld, I was strictly an Irish gangster. And being so close to these high-level Irish people, we kind of started to understand what was going on. As far as, you know, they were protecting Whitey Bulger, and that Whitey Bulger was taking down his own people. He wasn't just taking down the Italians. He was taking down the Irish as well. And when I was working with the high-level Irish people, as I told you, the high-level Winter Hill Gang members, they had separated themselves from Bulger at that point because we kind of knew. You know, I mean, it really wasn't hard to figure out because, as I said, we're taking this up to my years from, like, maybe 89 to, like I said, maybe 94, when I was strictly an Irish gangster. I mean, we saw what was going on. You know, we shared rackets with Bulger's people. We shared rackets with the Italians. And I was into bookmaking, drug dealing, loan sharking, some union stuff. But we were always met with resistance by Bulger's people, and it seemed like the best thing to do was to stay away from him. And that's what those guys really drilled into my head, was that, look it, even though we all represent the Winter Hill Gang, Bulger is not with us. Stay away from him. And they all but said the words, but they never did say them, that, you know, Bulger was with the FBI. So it kind of interfered with a lot of our rackets, and it kind of gave me the heads up on it because I was close to these guys, and they were, you know, prior to 89, 90, when they got away from Bulger, and they figured that the best course of action was, if you don't want to have a problem with him, if you don't want to get fed to the FBI, then stay the hell away from him. But, of course, you know, it clashed. But, you know, a lot of our rackets were shared with those guys, as I was saying. And I didn't start getting with the Italians until the second wave of the war, as I said, like around 95, because by that point, as I said, Bulger and Frank Cadillac Salemi were on the whim. And, excuse me, the leaders that were still around in the Winter Hill Gang, they began introducing me to the Italians. And I really didn't understand why they were doing it, but they were actually putting me in the epicenter of the war, because that's kind of how Bulger did it, is that, like I said, he played the Italians against each other, you know, and these other Winter Hill guys kind of saw that strategy, is the fact that, well, what made him successful was the fact that, you know, they left him alone because, as I said, the Irish were a smaller group, and we kind of all knew that that was the game plan of the FBI. So if we could continue, in other words, I wanted to just stay with the Irish because I felt more protected, because I figured that they were going to go after the Italians. But, some of our rackets overlapped each other, and it was inevitable. I began working with both sides of the Italians, the Renegade faction and the Cosa Nostra faction.
Now, as you rise in organized crime, like you say, you're seeing things. People are telling you to be very cautious regarding some people. What about your relationship? Is there any strain on the relationship? What, as you go through these and you talk about, and I'd like to get you to give a couple examples of later on in the book where you go to a place and you have, again, this vibe, because you say you go to a restaurant that'll, a couple guys are in jail, and the guy goes into the restaurant and he knows that these people are going to, there's people going to say to these guys that are in jail, hey, these guys were in your restaurant. There's a lot of this one-upmanship that you talk about in your book, and I'll get you to a little bit later to give us an example of when you go in and you're intimidated, you're with your girlfriend, you see Bobby. These are fascinating stories that take us far beyond the sort of, you know, this guy bumped off that guy and took over his racket. It seems we get lots of that, but this personal story is really, I think, something that the audience is not as accustomed to in reading. So,
well, there's a lot of jealousy in the mob. I mean, you know, especially when your right-hand man, your best friend, the guy that maybe you looked up to, you know, when he goes to jail, you know, he's not living well. And when inmates are coming in and out of there from the street, I mean, they're yapping my name. They're saying, you know, hey, you're sitting here doing, you know, 5 to 7, and he's out there, he's with girls, he's making money, he's with this one, he's with that one. It becomes a jealousy issue, too, and it becomes where, you know, it's human nature. It's jealousy. It's envy. It's you know, what the hell am I doing in here and he's doing out there? And that's what it is in the mob, is everybody's trying to one-up the other guy. You know, you might be friends with a guy for 5-6 years, but the whole time you're friends with him, all he's trying to do is play you, because he needs to make sure that he makes that decision to turn on you after he knows your rackets, after he knows what you're doing, because, you know, I'm better off alive to somebody until they know my rackets, until the time is right, until, you know, the reason to get rid of me would be to take my, you know, to take over my earn, to take over my hustle. And that's what I began to notice. And there was a lot of personal situations, especially between me and Bobby. And that's when, you know, we talked about it earlier, when Maria got involved. You know, I saw the signs. I saw what was going on. And when you're in high demand, when you're a muscle guy, when everybody wants you, like everybody wanted the guy Bobby, you know, he's very, very easily influenced. You know, all someone has to do is in prison is approach him and say, you know, hey, you know, I heard this guy, you know, your buddy Mark, you know, I heard he's working with the Italians. I heard he's working with this one. You know, he's taking it all in, and he doesn't like it. You know, and it was just a really hard situation, because that's what it's all about, is like, you know, you don't have friends in the mob, you have associates, you know?
Well, can you tell us about the time that Bobby gets out of prison and you're out on a date with, you're out with Maria. Tell us about this, because that's a fascinating story. Tell us about the whole thing, the car waiting outside, what you told your buddy to do, the cop later. Tell us that whole story. That's an amazing account.
Are you talking about the beginning of the book, the attempt on my life?
No, not the beginning, no. When you're talking about when Bobby gets out and then you're with Maria and he comes in and you have this altercation at the restaurant. He says something to her, don't leave Maria. And
well, this is, I think what you're talking about is when I ran into him.
Yeah.
I'm kind of stuck between, I don't know. As far as that story goes, I'm kind of a little confused as to what they're talking about. I kind of don't. Can you be a little more specific?
Well, he, you said that he had come into to the restaurant. You were with a friend. You're on a double date. Maria's there. You hadn't seen Bobby in a while. He comes in, and then you don't know if there's going to be an altercation or not, but obviously you guys have this standoff between you, and then everything's fine. But you do tell your guy, hey, listen, get the girls outside, get them into the car, and meet me out front in case anything happens here. So,
yeah, that was there was actually an attempt prior to that on Bobby's life. He was somebody
That's right.
attempted to execute him,
mm-hmm.
and he took about 4 bullets. And
with blue eyes.
He was a survivor, and you know, I'm sure he was looking for somebody to blame, and if anybody had a good reason, I mean, I was probably at the top of that list. I mean, I was with this girl. They had made an attempt on my life earlier, prior to that, but we were on a double date with me and another top guy in my crew, and we decided to stop into a strip club, and the 4 of us walked in, and I heard somebody call my name, and it was a voice that was very clear to me. It was Bobby. And now he sees it. I walk in with the girl that he accused me of being with, and that I accepted responsibility for being with. And he was with another guy. He had some comments to say about her. He was really trying to get me going, and he was trying to belittle her. And at this point, you know, me and Maria are really into our relationship. I mean, we're not just on a fling. I mean, we're very serious. And I'm sure he wasn't happy about almost being executed. And, you know, he had some derogatory things to say. So I went up to the bar to get a beer. I got a long neck Corona. And I held it in my hand, and I walked over to their table. And I had my friend Joey Legs take the girls away from the scene. But naturally, Maria is very nervous because she sees me talking one-on-one at this table with Bobby and another serious wise guy. And she senses trouble. And he tries to get me going almost like I got him going. He was trying to get into my head. He was trying to make me – he was trying to get under my skin. And he was trying to make me make a mistake. He was trying to make me lose my cool. And he had some bad things to say. But long story short, as Maria kept peeking over and kept walking by, he called her a dirty name, and I didn't like it. And I just got right in his face. I told my friend Joey Legs the keys. I said, get the girls out of here. I said, stop the car up, wait out front. I said, because when I come out, I'll probably be running. Because, you know, I had the long neck beer bottle in my hand for a reason. You know, if something's going to happen, I mean, I'm going to do what I got to do. But
right.
It never really got that far. And I walked out of that place, and that was the end of that.
Well, you miss a little bit of it, though, because what I thought you would share with the audience is exactly what you did tell him. He had thought that somebody with blue eyes had killed him, and you do have blue eyes. And like you say, if there was a person that may have had a motive, well, you fit that bill and you have blue eyes. So after he bad-mouthed your girlfriend, you told them, hey, listen, are we going to have a problem here because you almost died last time? So you basically intimated to him that you were the guy. You put that idea in his head, and then you let him live And if
well,
you wanted to
appeal
him.
Exactly those words is, I said, I don't know for sure. I said, but maybe the shooter that day let you live, but I'm not sure.
Yeah.
I mean, I was the prime suspect. There's no doubt about it. I mean, you know all about crime stories and everything like that. It's always,
sure.
It's always the guy's girl, the girl's boyfriend that has the motive, you know.
Right.
And I do have blue eyes.
But you're not saying it was you, though.
No, I don't know who did that.
Yeah.
I don't know what happened with that. Could have been anybody. I mean, he botched the hit on me that was on contract by that was ordered from a boss. So, and there was other people that had that were maybe trying to capitalize on that. See, a lot of times in the mob too, the perfect scenario would be, let's say you're going to clip somebody, you're going to murder them, you're going to hit them, whatever you're going to do, you're going to shoot them. The ideal situation would be to make it look like somebody else did it, because that way the cops will wrap up that case, they'll send them off to prison, and the person who really did it doesn't have to worry about those charges coming against him because he's already framed up somebody else. So there was other people with motive, but I don't know who did that.
Right. Now, Scott, I wanted to ask you, and then if you can't answer it, I'll get Mark to answer it. But when I first started looking at this book, I said, okay, well, this is incredible information, sort of the access that Mark obviously has by virtue of who he is. He has this incredible access to this information. Now, you as a writer having written these books before, you don't want to step on the wrong people's toes. And, of course, you want to get the story straight. That would really piss somebody off if you got something wrong. Was there any challenge in this book to have Mark sort of, or at least from the information that Mark gave you, that you have said, oh, maybe this is a bit sensitive or that could be confidential or we may not want to say that because that's still pending in court? Tell us about that sort of challenge.
Yeah, you always have to be careful with that kind of stuff. for this book, a few of the things are some people's names were changed. I mean, that's really a one simple way of taking care of part of that. There was stuff Mark told me that we didn't put in the book. Mark's attorney obviously read through it. You want to make sure that, you know, when Mark's talking about, you know, John Smith, this guy, or he talks about Anthony Barry, you know, committed these crimes, you know, well, he was arrested for those crimes, and that's backed up. You know, you obviously don't want to get into a libel situation. But, you know, on the flip side of that, you know, Mark having the inside story, sometimes, you can't always verify it, so you have to maintain the integrity of Mark's accounts of it, but you don't want to just be making reckless accusations around someone. So there were certainly some stories where stuff we just either tweaked or took out or changed someone's name. So you always want to be cognizant of that. It's certainly something I think, even if you're writing historically, you want to try to be as accurate as possible and keep that.
Interesting.
I just want to say, and also make sure, you know, what Mark gives out is stuff that he's comfortable giving out. Because, you know, we talked a lot, and I always wanted to make sure if I wrote something, I brought it to Mark, hey, do you mind if we include this? This is a great story. And, you know, if he had heartache over it, we just wouldn't do it. So.
Yeah, right. Yeah, it's interesting. And Mark, in terms of, it just seems to me, I mean, again, maybe I'm not looking at it as carefully as I should or something, but is everybody that you're writing about okay with this? Are you sure this is okay? You're not going to get Khomeini'd here? You know, you're not going to get or Salman Rushdie'd, I mean? You know what I mean? You're not going to have somebody going, oh, somebody's coming after me? Are you absolutely positive?
I can never be positive about that. I don't expect people to be patting me on the back and saying, hey, great job, you know, and write nice reviews about it, you know. There's a lot of hurt feelings out there, and a lot of those guys are still around, you know, and I still live in the same neighborhood. I never moved or anything. I go about my business every day. I still run into some of these guys.
Sure.
But, you know, there's always that possibility, Dan. I mean, that's just the way it is. And I'm not really a shy guy, and I try to be truthful. but I also got to be smart. You know, I don't have an immunity deal with the government like most people do that write these kind of books where they can talk about, well,
yeah.
hey, you know, I whacked this one or I whacked that one, and they can give you the details of it. And I'm not saying I ever did anything like that. But,
no.
you know, if I did have an immunity deal, I could go into detail about that because obviously I would be protected from prosecution. But I'm not, you know. So, you know, as Scott was saying, you know, some of these stories – you know, I would have really loved to tell a great story, and I think I did pretty good, but
yeah.
I would have really liked to get into some details. But, you know, you got to worry about these overzealous lawyers, these overzealous prosecutors, the U.S. attorney. I mean, you know, I've been a target for a long time of these people and on crimes that never go away with no statute of limitations. But, you know, I don't – you know something – whatever happens, happens. I mean, we're all going to, you know, the one inevitability in life is we're all going to die someday. So maybe my day is going to be sooner than most. I don't know. But I'm willing to take my chances.
Mark,
why? Sorry. Go ahead.
I was going to say one thing added to Mark's thing, though. To keep in mind, too, that generally in even how many, you know, mob books have been written about guys exposing other guys, and there really haven't been the repercussions. And a lot of the stuff that Mark talks about, you know, by now here we are in 2012, we're talking about 10 years ago. You know, even some of the most current stuff already going on 5-6 years ago. So in talking with other guys that I know that were involved, their kind of answer is, you know, if I write about this guy, why is he going to come bother me now after all this time and make trouble for himself? So, yeah, they might not like it, and Mark might see him on the street, and it might give him the finger, say, screw you, but they're not going to go over and do something to Mark because then they're putting themselves in a position of, you know, being arrested. Or
they'd rather deal with today's problems. You know,
exactly.
there's a new problem every day in a mobster's life, you know, so it's almost in order of importance, too. You know,
yeah,
there's some hurt feelings. I'm not going to deny that. You know, and I got some hurt feelings, too. You know, so it's kind of a two-way street where, you know, I think Scott kind of covered it there, too, where, you know, a lot of these stories are old. You know, I don't know. Whatever happens, happens, I guess. But I think Scott clarified that.
Well, I think you obviously took, you know, you took great lengths not to be, like I say, you're not giving any information up on anyone, and it's very much different. You talk about immunity deal, but you're not, you know, you didn't testify against people, so this is a completely different book, right? You know, so the information out there is, like you say, you might ruffle some feathers, people might not like your depiction of things. I was going to ask you, though, why was this book important for you to write?
Felt like it needed to be told. You know, I was the guy that lived in the shadows for all of these years. I was the guy that put my ass on the line for the better of what I thought was this honor-bound society. I felt betrayed. I felt like people had to know that this is the way it works. This is the mob. This is the mob that people glamorize and that there's movies about. And, you know, here's the real inside stuff about the way it really, really works, you know, and I wanted to tell it, and I wanted to do it carefully, you know. It's not about talking about what guys did or what they didn't do or trying to trash someone. It's also, you know, I don't want to get them in trouble either. You know, that wasn't the reason for doing this. You know, whatever they've done or they haven't done, I really don't bring it up past 2002, 2003, you know, where they might be, you know, the statute of limitations wouldn't be helping them, if you know what I mean. I didn't put anybody in the fire, you know, and I was cognizant of that fact as I wrote the book. I don't want to do that, and I wouldn't expect people to try to do that to me.
Right. Scott, can you tell us about this is a very important part of the book where, and again, you do a masterful job capturing this, probably without, you know, Mark saying it and without the narrative really explaining it, it's the turning point in Mark Silverman's life, basically the attempt on his own life. And so maybe you could talk about that. That it's not the end of the book, but it's near the end of the book, where we talk about sort of this sort of, Mark is spoken about this throughout the interview, about, you know, he was disillusioned and now he realized and he could see there was no loyalty. But talk about that one sort of a near attempt, and then it just seems like there's a turnaround there where the light bulb goes off and Mark says, look, I've got to make a change here.
Yeah, you know, we Mark and I joked that was like the Hollywood scene, because it's, you know, it's fleshed out like, and so one of those just near miss scenes that you'd see in a movie, but it really
right.
happens. And I think in when Mark talks about that story and the way we wanted to write it was exactly what you said. It's here he is kind of coasting through this glamorous criminal life, and this is where exactly what he says kind of comes to fruition, where he really sees the depth of that treachery and how close he really was to dying, and at that moment, and that really hits home. And I think that opens his eyes, and then he starts adding up everything else that's going on around him. And then there's, you know, there's another smaller scene later where the FBI comes, and, you know, hey, Mark's working a regular job, and they say, you know, there's still guys looking to kill you. And you know, I think at that point, it really is clear to Mark that this was obviously not what, you know, he signed up for as a impressionable young guy.
Yeah.
It's not that life at all. And that scene, I think, really works well in that context, because, again, you don't have to say, he doesn't come out and say, hey, I almost got killed, I got disillusioned. You can tell by the way he starts reacting to things around him that that's what's going on.
Yeah. Tell us about that. Describe that scene for us, not to give away too much for our audience, but, I mean, just tell us about that attempt, your feelings, your gut instinct. Tell us about that whole event. It's very powerful.
With the FBI visiting me?
Just before that, and the FBI, yeah.
Well, Scott was kind of saying is that I really started to see it for what it was, and I realized the dangerous spot that I had really put myself into. You know, I mean, when you're inside of a mafia war, people know that you know a lot, and people that may have felt as that I betrayed them, and maybe in some ways I did, but, you know, that when there's two sides fighting, one of them's going to lose, one of them's going to win. So one of them's going to go home happy, and the other ones are never going to let it go. And they're not going to blame the feds or anybody else. They're going to blame me, because they're going to say, you know, we fought this war for 6, 7, 8 years, and the reason we could never win it is because this guy wasn't really with us. And when they found that out, I mean, my life was... it was just constantly in danger. I mean, I had visits, and like Scott said, I mean, I got a visit from the FBI, and I was working a square job, but the location of that square job was it was in a bad spot. It was in the territory of one of the guys that felt as though I betrayed him in the war. He was on the Renegade side. So the FBI came, and they said, you know, Mark, we have a moral obligation to inform you that we believe that there's a contract on you. And, you know, naturally I said, you should have told me this a year ago, because that's when the last attempt on my life was made. I mean, if you know about this one, you probably know about that one. And
what did they say to that?
Excuse me?
What did they say to that when you asked them that?
Oh, they didn't like it. Because they thought it was, you know, they thought I was trying to be cute, you know, but I was kind of being serious. Like, you know, you don't know about that one, but you know about this one. You know, what's going on? You know, why are you telling me? Why do you care? You know, and I really didn't take it serious, but in some ways I did, because they said that they had picked it up on a wiretap during one of their investigations. And see, the one thing you have to understand, too, is they can tell you that there's a death threat on your life, but they can't tell you where it's coming from. So as they were telling me this, I immediately knew right away who it was and maybe the investigation that they were into. I mean, just them telling me that gave me enough where I kind of, you know, I knew what I was into and I knew who my main enemies were. But that was also a ploy to get me to jump into their arms and to become a member of, as we like to say, Team America. You know, when there's a contract on your life, or they're telling you that there's a contract on your life, the normal mobster is going to jump into their arms and ask for protection because they're the only ones that can't protect you. At least they claim to. I mean, I don't know. I've never gone that route, but I don't know if I would trust them.
Yeah. Well, that's fascinating, yeah. Well, guys, gentlemen, I want to thank you very much for this interview. We could probably go on for another hour. This is an incredible story. But I want to thank you very much, Scott Deechy and Mark Silverman, for this Rogue Mobster. Very, 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 very interesting book. Fascinating inside access. And like I say, it's almost like you're inside a Sopranos, Goodfellas, Godfathers episode. You're cooking marinara sauce in prison there. It's like I'm going, man, this... Because I already know that that's where they get stuff from. They get true accounts, and, of course, they get somebody writing a little bit of drama and dialogue. But even the dialogue is in here. You know, this is crazy. So it's been really, really fun. This is a much different book, like, again, with all this information. And you and Scott did a really, really admirable job, and I want to thank you very much for, number one, for a great book, and, two, for a great interview. So thank you very much, gentlemen.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you for having us on. Appreciate it.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you very much. And for our audience, you've been listening to Rogue Mobster with Mark Silverman and Scott Deechy. Gentlemen, thank you very much and have a good evening. Good night.
You too.
All right.
Night.
Thank you.
Thank you.